yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket, and in the order of appearance, they are docket number 060598, Prodigy Communications Corporation versus Agricultural Excess and Surplus Insurance Company from Dallas County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 071059, Financial Industries Corporation versus XL Specialty Insurance Company, which is a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the 5th Circuit. And 060911, Edwards Aquifer Authority versus Chemical Lime Limited from Comal County in the 3rd Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these cases, and we will complete all arguments before noon. We will be taking a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060598, Prodigy Communications Corporation versus Agricultural Excess and Surplus Insurance Company.
May it please the court, Mr. Powers will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my worthy adversaries. Your Honor, in the PAJ, which I will call the Pash decision, this court held, and I quote, "We hold that an insured's failure to timely notify its insurer of a claim or suit does not defeat coverage if the insurer was not prejudiced by the delay."
Does it matter if it's a claims-made policy or a standard CGL?
Your Honor, that issue was left open by the majority opinion, and in my view, it does not make a difference.
Why not?
In other words, at the end of the day, is chocolate milk milk? The question of whether or not there is a material breach of a contract should not hinge on whether it is a claims-made policy or an occurrence-based policy. And the reason I say that, Your Honor, is focused on the language of the majority opinion. Ours is a claims-made policy. That is true. However, the notice provision in our policy, like the notice provision in POD, is subsidiary to the main insuring obligation, that is, a claims-made insuring clause. The notice provision is subsidiary. Secondly, the notice provision in our policy is not essential to the bargain for exchange, just as it's the same situation in Page.
But now in Page, we very much based our analysis on the continuum from Cutea to the board order in Hernandez. And we sort of said, in Cutea, we said this is up to the legislature or the Board of Insurance. And the Board of Insurance then acted. And we said, on CGL policies where the board's acted, they've indicated this policy. And we really tied it to what the department had done. And they've not done that as to claims-made type policies.
May I respond to that, Your Honor? Two things. First of all, while you did in your majority opinion speak in large measure about the board order, you also, that was pointed out in the dissent, that board order did not deal with the type of insurance that was at issue in Page. Okay?
Well, so, it dealt with CGL insurance.
That is true.
Occurrence-based.
But to look for that kind of direction from the state in our case would be to look in an impossible place. Understand that our policy is what is known as a surplus lines policy. By definition, it is not regulated by the state board. By definition, it is not regulated as to form and not regulated as to rate.
Well, if it's not regulated, shouldn't we just look to the plain meaning of the language and determine whether or not there was a breach?
Looking to the plain meaning of the language, let's talk about that for just a moment. This court in the Page decision, and I think rightfully, said one cannot blindly look to the plain meaning of the language. One must look to the economics of the bargain to decide whether or not something is truly a condition precedent or not a condition precedent. And that was kind of a cornerstone of what I thought was an enlightened view of the law of contracts in Page. Let me see if I can illustrate my point here. Whether something is a condition precedent...
But counsel, let me just be clear.
Yes.
You don't dispute that the notice provision here was a condition precedent.
I do.
Even though the language says as a condition precedent?
I absolutely do. And I'll tell you why, Justice Wainwright. It is this. Last night in my hotel room with nothing better to do, I read the policy, brought it with me.
You were really bored.
I was bored.
Now, it says something about a 90-day provision in there, doesn't it?
Texas was out of the... Well, anyway. So I read the policy. And do you know, Your Honor, that every undertaking, every covenant, every promise, no matter how small, no matter how de minimis, is a condition preceding the coverage under this policy? Let me point something out to you. Paragraph Roman numeral 8C of the policy... Action against the insurer. No action shall be taken against the insurer unless, as a condition precedent thereto, there shall have been full compliance with all the terms of the policy.
Imagine that.
Every policy.
Expect both parties to live up to their own promises in the contract. And, of course, your guys signed the policy with their fingers crossed behind them because you didn't intend to live up to your part.
Well, I don't know that that's the case. I think that if you looked
real... That's what you're here arguing. You signed an insurance policy that said that a condition precedent to coverage is due notice, and you didn't do notice practically, as soon as practical.
I think that any businessman who read this policy and purchased this policy in the marketplace would not think that his premium was calculated based somehow on whether he gave notice as soon as practicable. That defies modern...
How big a policy were we talking about here? What was the premium?
The exact amount of the premium, Your Honor, was $19,519.
And we presume they read the policy.
They're charged with reading it.
And if you didn't want a policy that, I agree, that's unusual, where you say every line is condition preceding. But if you didn't want that, you should have gone to somebody else, right?
Well, Your Honor, to think that these are negotiated policies
defies
the marketplace.
Those are standard form.
These are standard forms. These policies are, you know, while these are unregulated forms, these policies have their genesis in standardized forms that often are written by ISO. And the market...
So your position is it's these mean insurers who have gotten together and negotiated this standard policy we're going to impose on everybody, conditions precedent. All of your people wouldn't agree to that, but you have absolutely no choice.
Absolutely, I'm not attacking the character of the insurers. I'm only asking that the law of contracts be applied equally to all manner of contracts, and not favor the insurers.
There are circuits that make a critical distinction between claims made and occurrence policies. The Talcott decision from the First Circuit, for example, says that the purpose of the notice requirement in claims made policies is to ensure fairness in rate setting. If that's part of the reason that you have a claims made policy, why isn't that a sufficient distinction between this case and Page?
If we are to make a distinction between a claims made and an occurrence-based policy with respect to the timeliness of notice, may I respectfully suggest that that distinction depends on whether it is a claims made and reported policy as opposed to a claims made policy. In a claims made and reported policy, which this is not, and I'll explain that in a moment, in a claims made and reported policy, one can legitimately say that part of the bargain for consideration is that the only covered act will be a claim that is both made against the policyholder and reported to the insurer within a specified period of time.
But on a claims made policy, couldn't the insurer, after, let's say they know about the claim, the policy requires you to give notice. They may have actual notice, but it requires you to give notice. And they know that the period within which it was practicable to report the claim had expired. Why couldn't, at that point, they close the books and use whatever reserves they have toward other claims. Why wouldn't that be a legitimate activity on part of the insurance company?
My response to that is that from an underwriting standpoint, the language, as soon as practicable, is so vague and so amorphous that you would never underwrite against such a term. Now, if in fact you had a policy provision that said we only insure claims made against the insured and reported within, say, 60 days after the end of the discovery period, you had a bright line where you could actually look and see when did the deadline come to report a claim to the insurer, I could at least theoretically see that you would have an underwriting change. That is to say, I could look at my book of business and I could say, look, it is now 60 or 30 days past the end of the discovery period. I can close my books on that insured risk period and thereby write new policies. But the language, which is the same language in PAGE, to give notice as soon as practicable is so vague and so amorphous.
That is, but it also says, but no later than X days. Now, what if you had a claims-made policy with a tail, or what if you had an excess policy with that same type of language? Is there a distinction?
Well, Your Honor picked up on some language in this policy, if I may answer. I think I'm answering your question, and tell me if I'm not. We did that. In this case, the policy provision, the notice provision said, thou shalt give notice as soon as practicable, but in no event later than 60 or 90 days after the end of the discovery period. We did that. We gave notice within the safe harbor.
Within the 10 days.
I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you are to draw a distinction, you know, between an occurrence policy and a claims made policy as regards notice, with respect to when could they close their books on that risk, we did that. We gave notice within the safe harbor provision of the policy, and if we're going to divine some underwriting intent here, that there was the ability to close the books if there was no notice given to the insurer within 60 days after the end of the discovery period, we did that.
Why should the court look to underwriting intent?
Well, I think you have to. I think you have to start with the proposition that absent a material breach, and that's judged by the facts, absent a material breach, the non-breaching party is never relieved of his obligations. For example, what if it said, "Is a condition precedent that thou shalt give notice in green ink and deliver it to a certain post office box?" I don't care if you use the words condition precedent or not. We all know that no underwriter actually calculated premium based on whether or not green ink was used to give notice.
It doesn't seem to me that it'd be in your benefit to try to figure out what the intent of an underwriter is when we're trying to figure out what the language of the policy is, and either for your position make it consistent with PAGE or make it a distinction.
I'm only advocating what this court, I think, did in PAGE, and that is, in order to decide whether the clause in PAGE was in fact a condition precedent or a covenant, I think, if I read the court's opinion correctly, the court had to divine whether the notice provision was an essential part of the bargain for exchange. Well, how does one do that unless one tries to understand the economic reality of the contract in question and to decide whether the condition in question was truly essential to the underwriting risk that's being assumed or essential to the transfer of risk being negotiated by the policyholder. You have to divine what the economics are of that contract. I mean, did it matter whether you gave notice in green ink? Of course not.
Should it make any difference to us whether a prejudice requirement is part of a majority trend across the country or not, and is it in claims made policies?
I think that it is important because I think it recognizes an awakening of the courts to the realities of the marketplace with respect to insurance. You know, we all say that insurance contracts are just like any other contracts and should be construed just like any other contracts, but you know, we don't do that. I mean, we don't do that. We recognize that there are public policy considerations at play when you're dealing with insurance. For example, normal contracts, if there's an ambiguity in the contract, what happens? You allow parole evidence in, right, with respect to the intent of the parties. Not in insurance contracts. If there's an ambiguity in the contract, it's construed against the insurance company. My point being that I think there is an awakening in the United States that policies of insurance are different. They are in the nature of, for lack of a better term, gambling contracts. It's a wager. You're putting down your premium. You're wagering that a certain event will happen and that my premium will be less than the benefits I receive under this contract.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
On this one.
Yes.
And in light of what you just said, suppose that the claim had been made the last day of the policy period. We'll just take a hard case.
Okay.
But notice was not given until the 91st day. And there were reasons why. I mean, it was a sorry chain of events, but anyway, we just didn't get to it till the 91st day. Would that be timely notice or not?
Justice Heck, am I correct that you're positing that it's given after the safe harbor?
Yes.
One day after the safe harbor?
One day after.
If you think that the notice provision, and indeed the safe harbor provision, was indeed essential to the bargain, then there is an argument that insurance, that the coverage would fail.
It's hard to see why the safe harbor and the soon as practicable would be treated differently.
Well, the safe harbor is a hard stop. The safe harbor is a hard stop, and getting back to whether there is an economic basis, an underwriting basis, for treating a claims-made policy differently than an occurrence-based policy, I think you'd have to you do see those two provisions very differently. As soon as practicable doesn't give you a hard stop. There's no way you could underwrite against that. A safe harbor arguably gives you a hard stop.
But how can you show prejudice if it's given one day late?
Well, I was about to say that I think that if you're going to make the distinction that some courts might make, that would be the result. I personally do not I think that you should have one rule, and that is you've got to show prejudice. You've got to show prejudice.
That doesn't allow the insurer to close its books, does it?
Well,
on a claims-made policy.
For example, if the insurer if the insurer could say, you know what?
Wait a minute. If it's prejudice, does it allow the insurer to close its books on a claims-made policy at the end of the discovery period or the reporting period?
If it's prejudice.
It
could be prejudice if let me see if I'm saying this correctly, if I'm understanding you correctly. Assume with me under Justice Heck's hypothetical that, in fact, the carrier did not close its books on the 90th day. Assume with me, in fact, the carrier didn't close its books until the 95th day. Notice is given on the 91st day. Then the carrier was not prejudiced by that one-day delay. So why have a different rule? Why don't we just embrace Corbin's modern economic analysis of contracts? And that is to say, look to see whether there was, in fact, any prejudice that occurred as a result of the late notice, be it a claims-made policy, be it an occurrence policy. Understand, here, there was a stipulation of no prejudice. They didn't come into court and say, Your Honor, we had closed our books. We had closed our books under this claims-made policy. Because,
okay, but let's go back to the 90th day. The claims made policy,
okay,
when it's reported the 95th day instead of the 90th day or the 100th day, and there is how's there ever going to be a showing of prejudice, and how's in the carrier on a claims made policy that you agree, as I understand, is given for the purpose of their being able to close their books and say that risk is gone now.
How would they do it?
And write some more. I understood that to be your position.
Yes.
All right. But if we are going to say no prejudice, we can always go to the insurer because they're not prejudiced. What difference does it make if they say 90 days or 100 days or whatever? You're going to you're going to always sue them and say they haven't been prejudiced by it. Who cares if they've closed their books?
Well, no, no, no. I think closing your books is a prejudice. I mean, in other words, I think that prejudice can apply. You can be prejudiced by late notice in a number of ways. You can be prejudiced because you weren't able to defend the case.
We're talking about a cutoff date.
Well, but to answer your question, Your Honor, if I may, if the carrier comes into court and says, "Look, I got this notice on the 95th day. I closed my books on the 91st day. Therefore, I was prejudiced because I'd already closed my books." Okay, that could be done. That could be their showing of prejudice.
What if they closed their books on the 30th day?
If
you didn't give notice till the 35th day, is there prejudice?
In other words, they say, "Well, look, you didn't give notice as soon as practicable.
Right.
We closed our books on the 30th day in reliance upon not having received notice because we think that that would have happened." Is there prejudice? As an abstract proposition, perhaps so. As a realistic proposition, no way. Because no underwriter is going to close their books on that.
Well, based on your discussion with Justice Johnson and your answer now to that question, then the safe harbor period is not a hard stop because it's flexible. It depends upon, according to your construct, as I understand it, when there's prejudice, which is determined by when the insurer can close its books on the risk. So that may be the 30th day or it may be the 95th day. But the 90-day safe harbor provision, which you called a hard stop, doesn't seem to be a hard stop anymore.
I was talking in terms of, as an abstract proposition, I could see how an underwriter could use a date certain as a hard stop for purposes of closing books and calculating whether to issue new policies because they think a risk has been closed. It is, if you put 10 underwriters under oath and you said, "Would you actually ever close your books because you think somehow there's a date out there where as soon as practicable a claim would have been brought," they would tell you that's silly. I mean, it would not happen. I mean, it's too vague. It's too remote.
Counselor, I think the question has been asked and answered, and we'll have an opportunity in another case, and you will on rebuttal. So the court now is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Borders will present argument for the respondents.
Morning. May it please the court. This court's recent decision in PAJ, or PAJ, does not control the outcome of this case for three reasons. First, as the majority in PAJ noted, there's a critical distinction between the occurrence-based policy in PAJ and a claims-made policy like the one at issue here.
And let me ask you about that.
Yes.
The critical distinction we drew was the underwriter's ability to close its books to set future premiums.
Correct.
If that was sort of the prejudice piece, that if a notice is given beyond the claims made period, then we sort of presume prejudice. But if the claim is made in a manner that doesn't preclude the underwriter from making future premium on current claims, then why doesn't it fit the same construct as Page? We drew the distinction in Page, clearly.
Yes.
But it seems the substantive basis we drew the distinction on wouldn't apply here.
Well, Your Honor, perhaps I misspoke when I said about closing the books. The idea behind the claims made policy is essentially to minimize the unknown as much as possible. Uncertainty is what drives up the price of insurance. When I started practicing D&O law 15 years ago, a company that had $40 million worth of D&O insurance was considered perhaps overly insured. Today, companies that no one's ever heard of carry $200 million worth of D&O insurance, plus an additional bit of insurance that covers only the directors and officers because of the inflation and different theories.
I presume the premium's gone up accordingly as well.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the premiums haven't gone up as much as they could have, mainly because of the limited window that claims-made policies provide as far as when we can close their books, that there's not the long tail coverage. I don't need to know whether a wrongful act or a claim that happened today, what it's going to cost me 15, 20 years from now. And so the critical distinction in the claims made policy is that as you're setting premium, and you're negotiating these policies almost immediately after they're issued, you're starting to negotiate the policy for the following year. This policy at issue here was not an ISO form. It was negotiated. There were 24 endorsements that were put onto this policy, one of which changed the notice provision of this policy. And so the notice provision of the policy, it's almost a continuum. On day one, there's a lot of uncertainty of the policy because you don't know whether any claims are coming on. 6 months into the policy, you have a pretty good idea that this is a good risk. There's not been any claims. So if we were only talking about a bright line cutoff after this 90-day period, in this particular case, it was a one-year policy with a three-year reporting provision, and the policy said that notice shall be provided as soon as practicable, but in no event later than 90 days after expiration of the policy. So under this bright line...
That's an odd provision, seems to me. It's as soon as practicable, but in no event later than a year and a half. It looks to me like if you were really serious about it, you'd say as soon as practicable, but in no event later than X days after the claim is made.
Your Honor, I think the answer to that is it depends on when the claim is made. The example was raised, what if a claim is made on the last day of the policy? And so but in no event later than 90 days was meant as a limiting factor because courts, there is some leeway in how courts have determined what's as soon as practicable.
But that's the part I don't understand because I see why you would want a limiting factor at the end, but it's hard to see why you wouldn't want the same limiting factor at the beginning.
Well, Your Honor, the reason is it was negotiated away. The original notice clause of this policy says shall provide notice as soon as practicable, here if I can, but in no event later than 90 days after the claim is made. That was the original notice provision in the form policy. That was changed by endorsement. And so the parties negotiated that we're going to limit it to
these parties in this case negotiated?
Yes, Your Honor. It's endorsement 15, I believe, to the policy. And so what the parties negotiated was, okay, we will stick to what's as soon as practicable. And depending upon the state, now Texas interprets the term as soon as practicable with a fairly short window. I believe 49 days was the shortest that I've run across, although an older case. But certainly 6 months is not as soon as practicable. Other states, you know, have looked at this and said, well, we think within a year is as soon as practical.
What if it was not negotiated away and this is a standard form language? Does it matter?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because of the nature of a claims-made policy. The reason these policies developed...
And that gets me back to my question,
yes.
And that is, you have stipulated no prejudice here.
Correct.
And that seems to me, by definition, to mean if you've stipulated no prejudice, then it doesn't affect your ability to set rates that distinguishes a claims-made policy from an occurrence policy.
Well, Your Honor, I think that, to a certain extent, begs the question, because with a condition proceeding, it's whether the notice... Whether the notice in this case is a condition proceeding is whether it's an essential part of the bargain for exchange.
Is every single act that's required by the insured under this policy a condition preceding, as your opposing counsel said?
It is not, Your Honor.
I mean, there was a pretty broad statement that every requirement under this policy shall be a condition preceding or something. I mean,
there's a no action clause in the policy that says as a condition preceding, the insured, as a condition proceeding to bringing suit against the insurer, the insured shall meet all the conditions and terms of the policy. So I think, as the dissent pointed out in Page, what that means is, okay, now we look at what was the term or whatever that wasn't satisfied by the insured. Now, in this case, the condition preceding language, we're not relying on the no action clause. This isn't a case where you have the risk in Page where you're bootstrapping everything. It had to be submitted on pink paper, I think was the example that was given, or didn't send in a deposition notice was the example that was given in Page, and therefore the insurer can walk away. This language of this clause is very specific, and the word condition preceding was used very judiciously. It says, the insured shall, as a condition preceding to coverage under this policy, provide notice in writing as soon as practicable but an annulment later than 90 days.
Now, let me ask you, I asked this question to the other side. Should it concern this court to look at whether there's a majority trend on whether prejudice is required to claim made policy? And is there a trend nationally on whether courts say that you have to show prejudice before you can decline coverage?
In answer to, I think, the first part of your question, certainly this court can take some direction from courts throughout the nation and determine and review those cases and determine which have been well-reasoned and which will enlighten the court in its decision. And as far as the trend is concerned, there are two trends at issue here. There's a trend nationwide, and it's a very strong trend, that in an occurrence-based policy, prejudice must be required for late notice. But in the claims-made context, the trend is the reverse. The trend is you don't need to prove prejudice in a claims-made policy.
But that's when the notice comes outside the claims-made period.
No, Your Honor.
No, okay.
In those policies, in many of those cases, the policy, whether it's a claims made and reported or a claims, or what he, I believe, opposing counsel is referring to as a general claims made policy, many of those cases involved notice of a claim given within the policy period. A claim made on day one, notice given 9 months later. And the courts have looked at that and said, no coverage, it's a condition precedent to coverage. Now, when we're talking about prejudice, I guess that would be, how is an insurer prejudiced by that? And so we've already stipulated that we weren't prejudiced because prejudice isn't required under Texas law, and certainly looking at the cases that we had when we
counsel, why is that provision in your policy?
Which provision, Your Honor?
About reporting as soon as practicable.
It's in the policy, Your Honor.
Does it make to the insurer?
Because these are notice policies. The entire idea behind the claims-made policy is to limit the time from when the insured event occurred.
I understand that, but if you write it for 1 year and you have a 90-day extended reporting period, is that correct? Or you have an extended reporting period?
We have an extended reporting period in this case, Your Honor, because FlashNet went out of existence and they bought runoff coverage.
Okay, all right. Let's take a situation where you have a one-year policy and you allow reporting within 90 days after the end of the policy.
Yes.
Let's assume that to be the case. Why then, what importance is it to the insurer that the claim be reported as soon as practicable within that period? Why do we even have that provision in the policy as far as the insurer is concerned?
For a number of reasons, Your Honor. One of the reasons is, as these policies aren't underwritten on the 365th day of the policy. The underwriting process continues throughout the year. I mean, it doesn't start necessarily on day one. Sometimes it does. But it starts sometime into the policy. And in order to determine what limits an insurance company is willing to provide, what the amount of premium there is out there, whether or not they're going to be able to get reinsurance for the policy, they want to know the universe of claims that are there. And the as soon as practicable language gives them some comfort. Not as much comfort as they'd like. In this case, we would have preferred 90 days after the claim was made, but some comfort knowing that it's not infinite, that this condition precedent in this policy says that you will give us notice as soon as practicable. So 6 months into the policy, if we've not received notice of a claim that occurred on day one, we have some confidence, not complete confidence, that no claim had been made.
Counsel, what's your best argument answering the question that even though I wasn't harmed, the court should enforce a provision that would eliminate coverage?
I think because to impose a prejudice standard in a claims-made policy would extend coverage gratis to the insured in this case. That the insured bargained for a policy in which they said, as they agreed, as a condition precedent, they'll give us notice as soon as practicable. If that can be ignored, then the whole purpose on a claims-made policy to eliminate tail coverage, to know when you can close your books, to know how to negotiate your premiums, ceases to exist. And so what the insurance industry will do is either increase the premiums for the policy, or in a case such as FlashNet in this case, which was a very difficult risk to place in the first place, just simply refused to offer it at all. And so coverage to the insured will be very expensive. That's why claims-made policies evolved in the first place.
If the term as soon as practicable is the operative requirement for providing notice, and I assume you would say it is.
It's one of two, Your Honor.
And the other is?
The 90-day cutoff.
Do you think that's a hard stop?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. I think what that is intended to do is in those jurisdictions where a year can be as soon as practicable, what we're saying is, yes, that's the case. But in this case, we're cutting it off. It's a limiting factor. That's why it's but in no event later than. It's a limiting factor on what can be as soon as practicable.
Let me make sure I understand you in terms of the ability to set rates. Do I understand your argument to be that you look at that on an individual insured basis, and when you're sitting down with that insurer trying to decide whether to negotiate another term on the claims made policy, it's important to you on a continuum whether claims have been filed as soon as practicable. So your argument is you're setting rates individually on an ongoing basis as opposed to broadly.
Correct, Your Honor. You're looking at, especially in directors and officers liability coverage, this is a very specific type of coverage, and it's the underwriting files on these things are fairly thick. You're looking at their 10-Ks, you're looking at their 10-Qs. The underwriters will be going on the internet to determine whether or not they've made any public announcements.
So you're setting rates individually on these policies as opposed to?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So why wouldn't it be simple enough, you know, to say in the sense that the claim comes in depending on what kind of claim is, how big it is, how it would affect things like setting limits and premiums and obtaining reinsurance and so forth that you described. Why wouldn't it be pretty simple to say, well, with this kind of claim, this is what was affected in setting these sorts of things to show prejudice to the company?
Your Honor, a review of the case law nationwide has shown that a prejudice standard is an awfully onerous term.
So you say it would be difficult.
It's difficult as the term with prejudice is interpreted by the courts. One court has gone so far as to say unless an insurer can prove that it would have gotten a better result than the judgment that was entered against the insured in this case.
So if we were to follow the Page ruling here, you're saying it would be too difficult to show prejudice. And, of course, we haven't gotten to the question of how do you show prejudice in these kinds of cases.
Well, it would be awfully difficult, Your Honor. I'm not saying it's insurmountable. We certainly have proven, insurance companies have proven prejudice in those limited states where usually the legislature has imposed a prejudice standard across the board on late notice policies.
But you stipulated no prejudice in this case.
Absolutely, Your Honor, we did. And I'm not arguing today that Great American E&S or Agricultural Excise.
Let me understand. As I understand what you've just told us, it seems like the underwriting is based upon every provision in the policy, whether you require it to be submitted on pink paper, in green ink, or whatever. Does the underwriting go to that much detail? Is that what you're telling us?
No, not at all, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that the underwriting is based upon as much, in these cases, because the risks are so high and the payments on these policies are so high, that information is key, and uncertainty is what drives up the price of the policy.
And on this policy, the premium that was discussed earlier was an upfront premium set for this policy. It's not a retro type premium in any manner. It's just a one premium for this period of time. Is that correct or not?
That is correct, Your Honor, although I believe this policy was a renewal. Because okay.
But what I'm saying is the claims during the policy period do not change the premium for that policy.
Not for this policy.
Not for this period.
It would, however, change the premium that would be charged for the extended reporting period that was placed on this policy. So, hypothetically, had a claim...
They bought it.
They did buy it.
Okay. So you can change that premium. They bought it at the front end for their $19,000 or whatever?
No, Your Honor. They paid a premium for the policy at the beginning of this policy, probably in the year, sometime in the year prior.
The $19,000 something we heard.
Right. And then at the end of this policy, when they knew that FlashNet was no longer going to exist and it was going to be subsumed by another company, they approached ASIC and they said, okay, we need an extended reporting period in case any claims come in when we were FlashNet. And so a premium was negotiated at that point for the runoff coverage during the course of this policy. And what I'm saying is if a claim was sitting out there on, say, the sixth-month period of this policy, as we're negotiating this extended reporting period, and so we don't know about it. They haven't told us about it.
Mr. Borders, about 18 minutes ago, you said there were three reasons why Podge was not controlling. You got out one of them, and then you kind of got taken off course a little bit, but I want to make sure I get the other two. I think we've probably kind of veered into them, but I want to make sure I get all three.
Okay. I'm sorry. Have I finished answering your question, Your Honor?
Go to Justice Willett. Okay.
The second reason is that in contrast to Podge, the notice condition precedent in this policy expressly stated right. That. It's a notice condition precedent.
I had a feeling that was number two. What's number three?
Well, if I may finish the thought on number two, is the problem in Podge, the green paper and everything's a condition precedent, was because there was a laundry list of items that appeared after that. In our notice provision, it says, shall provide notice as soon as practicable. And then it continues, and shall give reasonable cooperation that the insurer requires. So what I would argue is the cooperation clause that's tacked on to the end of this provision is a covenant. Because the condition precedent follows the you shall as a condition precedent give notice, prompt notice, and you shall cooperate as we reasonably request. So on the third reason is the board order in PAJ applies only to general liability policies. It doesn't apply to directors and officers' liability policies, such as the one that issues here. And the interesting thing with the sort of the alternative argument that Prodigy is making in this case is that they're setting up the problem that you've corrected in Podge to occur here. In Podge, the court was concerned that identical policy language would be interpreted two different ways depending upon the type of the claim. What Prodigy is asserting here is the notice provision will have to be interpreted two different ways, depending if notice comes 91 days after the end of the extended reporting period, or whether notice comes is just otherwise not as soon as practical. The results are fairly clear. If I may finish my thought.
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's presume a claim is made on day one of the policy. Policy says you give notice as soon as practicable, but no event later than 90 days after the expiration of the extended reporting period. Under the theory posited by Prodigy, claim made on day one and reported just under 3 years and 3 months later, 3 years and 89 days later, that's okay. There's no prejudice standard because we didn't cross the bright line cutoff of 90 days. Now, a claim is made on the last day of the reporting period, and they give notice 91 days later, bright line cutoff, don't have to prove prejudice. That's the kind of anomaly that this court corrected in Podge, that the parties to the insurance contract should be able to read the contract and know what it means and know what the standards are, and to apply different standards depending on whether it's a notice under a claims made, or what they're calling a general claims made, or a claims made and reported, shouldn't matter. And by the way, three courts that have looked at language very similar to this, where the notice provision wasn't in the insuring agreement, but was rather contained in a condition precedent and said, but in no event later than 90 days or 30 days, those courts that have looked at that language have said, that's a claims made and reported policy, not a claims made policy. They looked at it and said, that's a claims made and reported policy.
Any further questions? Mrs. Johnson.
One more.
Yes.
On your underwriting for your renewable or your tail periods.
Yes, Your Honor.
The underwriting you said is based upon claims made and reported during the period. You're constantly doing that underwriting to figure out what you're going to charge them if they want to buy an extended reporting period.
You're constantly trying to determine what is the risk in this policy.
Charge a premium up front, and now you're going to charge them a premium at the back end if they purchase an extended reporting period. And that extended reporting period purchase is going to be based upon underwriting what happened during the primary period. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Because
so if they don't report something to you, then they may have a lower premium that you have charged them for the extended reporting period based upon your underwriting of no reported claims.
Yes.
Okay, so you might, in that case, you could show prejudice if there was a delay in reporting. Is that a correct statement?
I think it would be evidence of prejudice.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I have just a few comments, a lot of the comments that were made by my worthy adversary. First of all, I think we heard 20 minutes of explanation outside the record of why there was prejudice here. I mean, 20 minutes we heard about how there was an underwriting prejudice that took place. But there was no evidence of that underwriting prejudice ever offered at trial. There was a stipulation of no prejudice.
Well, to be fair, I think the argument went to whether the notice requirement goes to the bargain for exchange. And so when you've got an ongoing negotiation that's necessary to an extended reporting period, I think the argument is it goes to the bargain for exchange between the parties in setting the rates, and they're not going to get into the prejudice argument.
Well, the only evidence of bargain for exchange we have in here is the policy itself. And there's no evidence of what was truly bargained for. If you look at the policy itself, what is the bargain for exchange? Section 1 is the insuring agreement. Section 1 says what is the risk transfer. Section 1 says it is insuring all claims made against the insured during the policy period, not claims made and reported during the policy period.
But that doesn't take into account the extended reporting period that was being negotiated.
No, Your Honor, the language is claim first made against the directors and officers for a wrongful act. It's either during the policy period or what's called the discovery period, okay, which is what happened here. The claim was made during the discovery period, okay, and it was reported during the safe harbor provided in the notice provisions. But what I'm saying here is that this is truly a claims made, not a claims made and reported policy. The centrality of the bargain is, as you would expect, in Section 1 of the agreement. The notice clause doesn't appear until Section 7, and it's under notice of claim. Okay? This gets to whether it's subsidiary to the main insurance bargain.
And on that subject.
Yes.
Sometimes, as they say, you can show prejudice, but sometimes that's hard. And you look at the cases around the country, and they go both ways. If you just wanted a bright line, if you just wanted to know on this day it has to be done or not, can you put that in a policy, or is that just not something that should go in a policy?
I guess it goes to whether it's central to the bargain, to answer your question candidly.
Probably not.
But if it's not, if it's just a notice provision, if all your, that's why I keep coming back to this Section 7. Your Honor, if you read that Section 7 in its entirety, it's dealing with what do you do when you get sued. Section 7C talks about having to forward as soon as practicable notice, copies of papers, investigations, pleadings, etc. I mean, under their construct, as in PASH, the failure to give a copy of a report as soon as practicable would forfeit your coverage, just as in PASH. In other words, the notice provision here is I like the word you used in your majority opinion. It's subsidiary to the main insurance bargain.
But that's what I want to ask you about before your time expires.
Okay.
If, for whatever reason, somebody is building a house and they just don't want to fuss about it, they want to say, if the carpet is not laid by X date, I'm not going to pay you other than this or something, try to make it not be a penalty. Can you do that in an insurance policy with notice?
Put it into the insurance clause. Put it into Section 1 to make it sure you're sure that that is the bargain for consideration. I'm insuring only claims made during this policy period and reported to me by not later than, say, 30 days after the end of that discovery period. That makes it clear that that's the bargain for exchange. That makes it clear that what you are selling here is not a claims made, but it is indeed a claims made and reported policy, and that's the risk you're underwriting. So that would be my response to that question. One, I'm almost out of time. I want to bring two questions, three observations quickly together. First of all, we had a concession by opposing counsel that the words condition precedent do not mean condition precedent all the time. Okay? You remember a question was asked by one of the justices about, is every provision of this contract a condition precedent? My opposing counsel said no. Even though the language in Section 8C of the contract, pull it out, says no action shall be taken against the insurer unless as a condition precedent there shall be full compliance with all terms and conditions of the policy. The admission made by my opposing counsel is an admission to the obvious. Calling something a condition precedent doesn't make it so. It has to be truly central to the bargain, and saying that it must be done in green ink or something like that doesn't make it truly central to the bargain. A tremendously important admission by opposing counsel.
What impact, if any, does your worthy opponent's admission to no prejudice have on the bearing of this case?
I think that that's the end of the argument. I fully expected my opposing counsel at trial to come forward with an affidavit from the underwriter to say, look, this notice hit us late. We closed our books. We did something to suffer some adverse consequence as a result of you not giving notice as soon as practical. They didn't do it. And you know why they didn't do it? Because of the point that Justice Hecht made in his question. He said, remember his question? He was, isn't this a rather odd provision? I mean, if you were really sincere about underwriting against a standard as loose as soon as practical, why didn't you say you must give notice within 30 days? After you receive notice. Why did you say, but in no event later than 60 or 90 days after the end of the discovery period?
Are there any further questions? Thank you very much, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.